Hello and welcome everyone to Leaders in Elder Care, the interview series designed to share with you some of the many people who are doing great things to change the face of elder care as we know it. I'm Ryan Malone, founder of Inside Elder Care and your host for the Leaders in Elder Care series. Before we start, I'd like to remind you to subscribe to the podcast. You can do so in two different ways. The first is to go to leadersineldercare.com. In the top right-hand corner, there's a subscribe button. And the second is to go to iTunes and search podcasts for Leaders in Elder Care, and you can click the subscribe button there. Let's go ahead and get started. Joining us today is Karen Love. Karen is a former speech pathologist and long-term care administrator with more than 25 years of experience in aging services. Through her company, Pathways to Care, Karen works as a consultant and educator. Besides a commitment to identify and promote effective evidence-based practices to enhance practices in aging services, she has a passion for quality dementia care. She's innovated a nationally recognized program utilizing Montessori-based principles to improve physical function and psychological well-being for elders and individuals with disabilities known as therapeutic engagement. Karen, how are you doing today?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
You're also very much involved in two groups, CCAL and SEAL, and I deliberately didn't read them as part of your profile because I only thought that it would do justice to have you explain your role and what those organizations do as part of the call today.
Okay.
So what inspired you, what inspired your interest and passion for assisted living?
I worked as a nursing aide in a local nursing home my senior year in high school, and that began my love affair and passion for working with the elderly. But I was, even at the age of 18, very disillusioned with the environment. I mean, this was a home where people were supposedly living, but it ran very much like a hospital. And I had residents, for example, that were on my evening shower list that said, oh, I don't want a shower now. I'm getting ready to go to sleep. I'd rather have a morning shower. And so with the advent of assisted living, about 25 years later, I realized that here was a model that might be able to change the institutional medicalization kind of format in long-term care as we had known it, or at least residential long-term care, and have something that brought the best of everything together to make a nice home to live in that you could receive some care and assistance.
Oh, very cool. And so tell us a little bit about CCAL and what your role in that organization is and how it came to be.
Sure. I was an administrator for an assisted living company, and there it seemed like the 6 years that I worked for this one particular company, there were assisted livings popping up on every street corner, and I realized that they were all over the map in terms of quality and what information was being given out. And it was very confusing for consumers to understand even what questions to ask, or that there were variations among the assisted living. And I ended up leaving in 1995 to found a national consumer organization to help get information and educational materials into the public so that people had some ideas. One of the very first things that we did as an organization was hold a diverse stakeholder conference, which was unheard of at the time. In other words, usually conferences were either for consumers or for social workers or for the administrators and owners and operators, but nobody ever had conferences where they invited all the different people to come together and kind of talk through and discuss the different items. And so that was the first thing we did, which helped inform and shape information for us from a consumer perspective. And then secondly, we created a handbook, a little guidebook on what consumers should ask, the type of information that would be important for them to know.
Interesting. So what was the, I know that there's ALFA, which is primarily an industry group for assisted living. And I know firsthand that consumers aren't really, I guess as invited as the practicing assisted living providers and related industries. So what was the response and the reaction from the industries who were used to just talking amongst themselves when you started inviting different crowds?
Well, it's a good question, because in the beginning we were, the Consumer Consortium on Assisted Living was really looked at like a threat.
Uh-huh.
Because on the nursing home side of things, there was a national consumer advocacy organization that very much focused single purposefully on what residents, or what they felt that residents needed. But unfortunately, that organization never had anybody who had actually worked in nursing homes and knew the culture. They may have been ombudsman or ancillary, but really didn't understand the culture thoroughly. And if you're only hearing about the bad things, then you tend to think that everything is bad. CCAL started very differently. Our board from the very beginning had a diverse composition. We very carefully made sure that we continually were in the field talking to wide stakeholders, not just consumers, but for example, professional geriatric care managers, consumer advocates for sure, but maybe having a slightly different perspective. So we felt like we were really very much involved in gaining information, and we were treated very skeptically until about 7 or 8 years, and finally we had developed enough credibility and our own reputation as true collaborators for others to see us as non-threatening.
Ah, very good. And how long has CCAL been around?
Well, we formed in the latter part of 1995, and then incorporated as a charitable nonprofit organization the following year in 1996. And I continue on. I was chair for many years, and I continue on in the organization as its founder.
Ah, very good. So in addition to the first two things that you did, can you share some of the accomplishments that CCL has achieved?
I think probably one of the accomplishments that I am most proud of is taking that collaborative spirit. And rather than each of the stakeholder organizations special interesting, which they continue to do to some degree, but we, through the efforts of the U.S. Senate on Aging, were able to help bring together a national initiative that we called the Assisted Living Workgroup, and it included 48 national organizations. And we came together and worked for 18 months to develop recommendations soup to nuts on every single conceivable operational aspect of assisted living, from pet policy, smoking policy, resident rights, what kind of credentials and background administrators and direct care staff needed. It was really a very thorough, comprehensive look. And from that, from the end of that 18-month initiative, we released a report that had, now to us, consensus was two-thirds, and we had 110 consensus recommendations that were agreed upon. So I'm very proud of that, and the follow-on to that was the creation of a new nonprofit that memorialized the continuation of this diverse stakeholder group coming together on a regular basis. And must have been in 2004, the latter part of 2004, we incorporated the National Center for Excellence in Assisted Living, which is a composite organization of 11 national organizations, including 4 consumer advocacy groups, 4 assisted living provider groups, and then 3 other, as well as a very broad-based, diverse advisory council. So the idea of coming together to continue to talk and dialogue from multiple perspectives to focus on quality and excellence continues to this day.
And that's SEAL.
And that is SEAL, yes.
Ah, okay. I understand now. So what is your role in SEAL today? And you shared with me the inspiration for the group, but where do you know, what does SEAL do day to day, and what's their role in the broader assisted living a journey? I guess I'll use what could be a good word.
Sure. I was one of the founding board members for SEAL. And as I said, we started work in 2004. The following year, about 18 months later, I guess, I ended up stepping in as the managing part-time. I work about 65% of my time as the managing director for SEAL. And we are this year celebrating a five-year anniversary, and to celebrate that, we have kicked off a national awards program in six different categories to recognize practices of excellence in the field, and practices of excellence not just in operations within the assisted living communities themselves, but also practices of excellence that happen with policy and research. So broadening the sector and recognizing the fact that we don't work in isolation. It really takes research. There's an important role there, very important role for policy. So that program will announce the award winners this coming October.
Very cool. You must be excited. 5 years?
Oh, very much so. And we've actually, 5 years doesn't sound like a whole lot of time, but we've been able to accomplish quite a few projects, one of which it was a project funded by the U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Policy that SEAL partnered with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It was the first funded project in the aging field to utilize a new research methodology called community-based participatory research. And what's unusual about that is in traditional research projects, community members may be involved peripherally or involved in an advisory capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But in CBPR research, the community members are an integral, equal part of the partnership. And so we studied, for example, medication management. So one of the partners, community partners we had in this project, was a medication technician from Iowa. Now, here is somebody who had a high school degree, but certainly did not have a PhD, and was not familiar with, analyzing data and statistical issues and things like that, as were most of us community members. We're also untrained in this area. But that's what's unique about CBPR, is the researchers educate the community members about areas that they're not familiar with, while the community members educate the researchers about the topic being studied. So you end up having a much more comprehensive and accurate framework from which to do your research. So we're very proud of that that effort.
And I would imagine in that particular case, the med tech has dramatically more experience, grassroots, on the ground, feet on the street type knowledge of what's really happening in medication management that you just can't get from reading a book or a magazine or even a telephone.
Exactly. And that's all, in many instances, that's all these people do. So they may not know a lot about many things, but they know a lot about this particular thing that we were studying. The experience bore out the real value and the benefit of having, those voices to be able to, when we looked at the different data, to be able to say, well, but, here's what happens in real life. And so, maybe this, we're not interpreting or we're not looking at this accurately. So very, very valuable. And one of the things that we were asked to do as part of this research project was to write a manual on community-based participatory research, which we have done, and it is available to, and accessible to download for free from the SEAL website, which is at www.theseal.org.
So is that does the manual tell people how to implement the community-based research model?
It's a how-to. It'll walk you through all the different components, plus give you lots of resources and other means of gathering more information.
So basically, I guess if I can paraphrase the punchline, if someone, you know, an advocate in the community wants to study a particular issue and they want to use this philosophy, this manual will help them do that?
Absolutely.
Very good. And then I'm assuming that you would be pretty eager to get the research back.
That would be helpful, yes. In fact, there's a whole network of people out there, I've come to find out, on this community-based participatory research. So there's this whole network and listserv community, and everyone is very good about sharing information.
Oh, neat. I didn't even know that existed. That's really cool.
Yeah.
I know a lot of times when you read research, you wonder if, you know, usually it's a statistician, how much they really know the topic versus how much bias gets introduced or how much real knowledge doesn't get introduced because the person designing the study is too textbook-oriented.
Exactly. And that's what you hit the nail on the head with that. That's what makes CBPR so very, very important. There are two aspects of this methodology of research also that you don't see in traditional, and that is, and there are formalized steps. There are, I believe it's 9 off the top of my head, steps, and the last two are to then take your research findings and look at it through policy implications. In other words, what did we learn, and what, if anything, policy-wise, needs to be reconsidered. And then the last is dissemination. So typically in research, the researchers will publish journal articles in peer review journals, which are not read very widely outside of the research community, which is one of the reasons why very few evidence-based practices are utilized in the field, because there's no mechanism to kind of hook the two together. Well, it's one of the things with CBPR is that you do very formally sit down as a group and you look at, you know, what are the policy implications. And I'll give you an example from our study. We were looking at medication administration in 2 states, Tennessee and South Carolina. Tennessee requires nurses to administer medications, whereas South Carolina permits medication technicians with, I believe it's 8 hours of training to administer medications. And one of the findings was that the med techs made no more errors than the licensed nurses did. So that policy-wise opens lots of potential doors. There are, I believe, currently 18 states that require nurses to administer medications in assisted living. So, you know, given training and supervision and oversight, this may be a strong way of having medications administered very appropriately and affordably, especially since we have a nurse staff crisis in our country where we don't have enough nurses to go around. So literally, you take those findings and then, you know, figure out what are the next steps, and then continue to work that.
Interesting. So that empowers a lot of people as opposed to keeping all of the power at the top, I guess is a good phrase.
Exactly. And that was one of the things
grassroots,
that we took from you know, our experience with the Consumer Consortium on Assisted Living, and that was the need to bridge research, policy, and practice. Each of those sectors are very insular and in many instances very siloed. And, you know, as consumers would butt into, for example, policy issues that affected them. For example, maybe there's a state that has a very low level of how long somebody can continue to live in assisted living. So that's a policy issue if somebody wants to age in place and continue to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we take research that, you know, helps inform policy, you know, and get the two, you know, talking and collaborating.
So where do you see SEAL then having the biggest impact on assisted living?
Well, SEAL has a very strong 11-member board of directors that are very involved, and part of its self-identified role is to continue to push the bar in areas that help promote and foster practices of excellence, and in doing so in ways that maybe others aren't looking at. So, for example, the community-based participatory research. We have done a lot of national discussion and presentations about this so that others can understand and hopefully consider it as a research methodology for them to use. And we continue to look at projects that nobody else is doing, but that has a wide and applicable outcome. So, for example, every state has different regulations and different, perhaps, information that, you know, they may or may not require a provider to disclose. So one of the projects that SEAL was involved, it took about 2 years to set it up, but it is what we call the Assisted Living Disclosure Collaborative, and it is a national initiative that SEAL has partnered with the U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, as well as another, I believe it's 15 or 16 organizations, national organizations, such as the National Association of Social Workers, to form and develop a uniform consumer disclosure tool that hopefully all of the states will adopt, so that if you're a consumer living in California, but perhaps your mother is interested in moving into assisted living in Michigan and you're trying to do this long distance, there's a common set of information regardless of where you live. So that's a project that we're in phase one of three phases, and I think we're looking at about another 4 years of the project, not the least of which will include getting states on board with this as well.
Wow. So you definitely have your hands full.
Well, and as I say, picking projects that have wide application and are things that nobody else is looking at.
Yeah. So if you look at futures then, you know, for both CCAL and SEAL, what are those two organizations' long-term plans?
Well, let's start with the Consumer Consortium on Assisted Living. And one of the changes since we started in 1995, back then you could hardly find any consumer information at all. Nowadays, so almost everywhere you turn, there's free consumer information, and many of it very, very good. So having getting information and resource materials, which was high on our list many, many years ago, is no longer something that we have to focus on. So we are putting our focus into other growth areas, such as the Disclosure Collaborative. CCAL has been very, very involved in bringing in the consumer voice to that national initiative. And that's really where I see CCAL expending a lot of its energies for the next 5 years, is continuing to ensure and foster that the consumer voice is present in these national discussions. So that's CCAL. From SEAL's perspective, long-range plans, we hope that the awards program that is newly initiated this year will continue to grow and expand, and that we will see, you know, this year, you know, if we get perhaps 50 submissions, I think we'd feel very pleased with that. But it would be wonderful in the next handful of years to be able to see, you know, several hundred submissions, so that there are that many practices of excellence happening in the field and that we can shine a spotlight on them. One of the things that SEAL maintains is a national clearinghouse of information. It's a virtual online library And again, you would go to www.theseal.org, click on Clearinghouse, and then you can write in there keywords, maybe consumer information or research on dementia, workforce practices, you know, whatever it is you want to search. And this large database of information comes up. So one of the things with the awards program is we will include a new category on there of the award-winning submission. So in other words, we won't include on there every single thing that's been submitted because it might not all meet our criteria for excellence. But certainly the ones that do meet that will get on there. So wouldn't it be wonderful 5 years down the road to be able to go into the clearinghouse under the awards category and just see it wonderfully populated with all of these great practices and ideas?
That sounds a lot like what we're doing right now. And from my perspective on my show, you're one of them. So
this interview will be
posted in that same manner. That's really cool. You know, it's award programs and things like that, I think, are really neat, not just because of the recognition standpoint, but you can really find people who are doing really unique things. And I noticed this with this show, is that you find people that are doing really cool stuff, but they don't necessarily know how or care to even, you know, talk about it outside of their own little ecosystem. And
yes, they're not
that,
into self-promotion. They're into the actual practice.
Yeah, or they don't even know how, and it's really powerful when you start being able to expose those types of things like we're doing today, that for everybody else to get a feel that some people want to participate, some people modify an idea, you know, some people get inspired. It's just really powerful.
Well, and we certainly, both CCAL and SEAL, fall victim to that. We're very busy out there doing these things, but, you know, not so good about taking the time you know, to talk about what it is we're doing and publicize and disseminate that. So I thank you for this opportunity for us to do so.
Oh, that's my pleasure. So if people, you've given a couple website addresses, but maybe we can just go through them one more time for the people that are listening.
Sure.
If people want to either help, contribute, or be part of an organization like these or learn more, walk us through contact information for both groups.
Okay. CCAL is a charitable organization. So if anybody would like to contribute, that would be really terrific. And its website is www.ccal.org. And there's lots of wonderful information and resource material on the site for consumers and prospective consumers of assisted living. And then we've got a little audio feed of our video. We have a terrific video because sometimes people need to actually walk through and see what does a large assisted living look like? What does a small one look like? You know, what are the differentials between a place that does specialized dementia care? And those are the kinds of things that the video actually walks you through. And it's told through the voices of assisted living residents and family members, as well as advocates. Then the contact information for SEAL is, the website is www.theseal.org. And we spoke earlier about the clearinghouse, and that you would click on once you get onto the home page, click on the clearinghouse.
Well, awesome. So, Karen, thank you so much for your time, and thanks more importantly for being a leader in elder care.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
My pleasure. For our listeners out there, a reminder, be sure to check out two websites, Inside Elder Care, which is a by families, for families approach to helping families deal with elder care issues. It's available at www.insideeldercare.com, and Portrait of Our Parents, which is a place that you can share stories, unique stories of your loved ones, and it's those stories that define them and make them who they are that you want to memorialize. On a website, Portraits of Our Parents is the place to go. It's www.portraitofourparents.com. Have a great day. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and come back and listen again soon.